Good morning, church. Glad to see everyone. Glad we made it to worship the Lord our God together. This rainies are here a little bit. Sunday morning. I had a nice Saturday yesterday. I got to see Oliver Sheeler and Ian Heater shoot some baskets and play a little kids basketball game. Kind of fun. Always good things to laugh at and get to encourage and support some families we love. I even got a run in yesterday. You know, I've been trying to be healthier. And part of that is I go on these little 2 to 3 mile runs. And I feel like I'm starting to learn a little bit about running culture. I'm learning the things I shouldn't do, like drink a bunch and eat a bunch before I go on runs. I'm starting to figure out, well, stretching is actually helpful if I spend a minute doing that. You know, just little things like that. Even figuring out, like, listening to music, how the beat kind of can keep me going. And if it's a slow song, I slow down. If it's a little quicker song, I'll speed up. And anyway, here's some stereotypes of other runners that I find on the road. And I don't know if this is accurate or not, so some of you running people can tell me. But I kind of, like, have categories of other runners. And so the first one I call the ponytail encourager. It's these women who are out there, and they got the ponytails swishing, and they're just like graceful, like a little gazelle, you know, just bouncing around. And and then I see them, and they just give a little smile and a little hand wave like that. And it just kind of makes me feel like, hey, I've joined some kind of elite club now, and I'm part of this new group, you know? And so that's kind of fun. And the second category, stereotype of a runner I see out there, I call young punk. And young punk doesn't make eye contact with me. He's too busy just, like, tearing it up. Not only is his pace, like, way quicker, he travels like three times the distance in one stride, and he doesn't have time for someone like me. And so he's kind of, there's a little arrogance in it too. It's like the arrogance of youth. And I think when I see young punk, I think, your time will come, my friend. But then this is my favorite group, the social peer. The one I respect. And these are the guys I kind of look at, and they kind of look at me, and we recognize the gray, we recognize the male pattern balding, we kind of guess what our, A1C number might be. I think you're about a 6. Yeah, you probably look at a 6.5. Yeah, you're in the pre-diabetic, but you're out here doing it. And what I love about my peer group is there's kind of this recognition, and we do make eye contact, and we do that little guy, like, I see you. I see you. You're doing it. Yeah. Part of my tribe. So that's just some of my running observations. I don't know how accurate that is, but kind of fun. But to dig into our discussion today on deacons, the last 2 weeks we've really spent a lot of time just talking about character. What is the character of, and so Acts chapter 6, we spent time there, and then 1 Timothy 3. Well, it's interesting, this is all a discussion specifically about deacons, but really this is a discussion about Christian character, because all of the criteria that you see for deacons in 1 Timothy 3, almost all of those are found in Ephesians as well. So when Paul writes the letter to Ephesus, all of these things show up as well. So what is the difference between a deacon and just a Christian? Well, one of the criteria for deacon is they're tested and proven in it. And that means not only do we all have the same criteria, but in some way, the fruit of those characteristics are found and proven in a person's life who is going to be serving in that role in a formal way for a congregation. So deacon character is important Because if you have deacons who don't take their work seriously, they don't have integrity in it, and if some of these jobs end up falling to the ground and not being done, it becomes a distraction that derails what's going on in the whole church. If you have unreliable deacons, or you have deacons with character flaws, a church is going to be less effective. A church is going to be distracted. Sometimes elders and ministers will end up being distracted by work that really should be done by deacons. And when a church doesn't have functioning deacons, it pulls away from the ministry of the word. It pulls away from prayer. It pulls away from shepherds being able to shepherd, teachers being able to teach, disciple makers being able to disciple. It seems to throw the mission of God onto the back burner. That's why character is so important for our deacons. Well, what do good deacons do, or what should they do? Identify and meet tangible needs. Protect and promote church unity. Serve and support the work of the elders. I think first one, a deacon should be skilled and take some initiative in spotting practical needs and finding ways to meet those needs the most efficiently and effectively. And I think that goes beyond just identifying current problems. A good deacon anticipates things that could be a future problem as well. The second one, protect and promote church unity. A deacon should be protecting what happens in the church, the families of the church, the unity of the church. That's why that criteria of the way deacons use their words, not being double-tongued. They have to be careful in the way they communicate with others. Don't want to foster anything that's going to create a division or divisiveness in a church body. And third, deacons' work allows the church to keep the priorities as the priorities while taking care of very important nuts and bolts kind of things that need to get done around here. We want to keep our shepherds shepherding. We want to keep the preacher preaching. We want to keep our teachers teaching. People who are making disciples, we want them doing disciple making. And let me also just throw in there that the most effective deacons, they don't do everything themselves. They mobilize others to carry out ministry. And they get in there and they do it together with them. And they model things together with them. But they help facilitate work in the church. So in summary, I would say good deacons, they don't need to be babysat. They can be trusted and relied upon to execute and expand their sphere of service ministry. They don't need, when a deacon is mature and has grown up in his role, they don't need constant supervision or correction. They don't need someone breathing over their shoulder. They man up and they're taking their responsibility on. So, what specific jobs do deacons do? Just let me say a word about that. This is something that each local congregation, I believe, it works out and decides. And so a deacon role may be specific to one specific church, the way it's broken up. But historically, these are things that we commonly find deacons doing. Visiting the sick. They're together visiting those who are mourning. They're visiting the elderly and shut-ins. Of course, this is stuff that all Christians are called to do, bringing them communion. Following up with those who haven't been, they haven't seen. I haven't noticed you've not been here, you know, or just trying to build relationship with people. Putting themselves out there a little bit to kind of be the boots on the ground within the church, so to speak, not isolated to themselves, like, leave me alone, I got my own thing going here. Deacons run benevolence and hospitality ministries. They care for the maintenance of church property or facilities, probably both of those in some way. They help attend to and organize church worship. There's a lot of moving pieces that are involved in our worship together, from finding our song leaders to how we organize our communion, finding our volunteers to do different works, running the sound booth. All of that takes a degree of organization. And then deacons run specific church programs and campaigns. Maybe those are not even like a long-term thing. It might be a fundraising campaign. It could be a special training or a special event that is coming up that they're involved in helping organize that, you know, doesn't maybe last all year. But these are just historically some of the good works that deacons have been known to do. All right, so some of you have been curious to know how I was going to address some of the textual considerations from Romans chapter 16, verse 1, and 1 Timothy 3:11 that seem to indicate women serving as deacons or deaconess in the early church. So to frame the conversation as your preacher, let me just say it's not my job to dictate church policy with any of this, but to present the word as clearly as I can to the best of my ability, understanding that my understanding is also limited. And while I do study these things, I don't think I'm perfect in everything. But I also think to just kind of ignore stuff like this and to try to shrink back and not deal with the hard conversations just because they happen to be a little more controversial, that ends up being detrimental in the long term to the health of the church. We need to be a place that we can talk about these things openly and discuss them together and realize that we keep this in the perspective of the most important things as the most important things. I really don't want a discussion like this to ever become a distraction to the mission of God and the work of discipleship. And so under that umbrella, we should be free to be able to discuss these things together. But let me just say that the entire ethos of what we do together in our interactions with one another in the culture of this congregation, I hope most of all that it's characterized by humility, by mutual submission, by acts of service. And I will say that male chauvinism is always inappropriate in the body of Christ. We simply could not function without the good works and good hearts of the women of this church. I think we all recognize that, and we need to acknowledge that from the beginning. So regardless of what your individual opinions are on this issue, for our congregation to be healthy, we need to honor and value the women of this church. We need to celebrate the gifts of our women. We need to encourage the good works of our women. We need to encourage the growth of our women. We need to champion and facilitate the ministries entrusted to our women. So I'm going to try to present the best arguments against deaconess or women serving in deacon roles, and then the best arguments that I've read for them serving. And then you can kind of hold these things. And of course, I always make resources available if you want to know what my sources are. If you want to ask me more questions, I'll do my best to answer as best I can. So what are some of the arguments against women serving in this role? Well, by example, And it's maybe not talking about deacons specifically, but a role that, what grew into the role of deacon. The Jerusalem church only selected men to wait on those tables. They could have chosen women potentially, but they didn't. There was something there that they wanted certain quality of men to be in that situation. It is possible to translate the word for women as wives, referring to the deacon wives in 1 Timothy 3. So this, it comes down to this Greek word right there, gunakas. Gunakas could be translated as women or wives. And to say wives is not without precedent in that. And then Romans chapter 16, it is possible to translate the word diakonon as servant. And that is a legitimate translation of that word. And then this is more a practical one. A deacon work, as practiced in many churches, entails a measure of authority. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 12 says, I do not let women teach men or have authority over them. And not to throw another church under the bus, but the Kaiser Church of Christ, when I was talking to them about deacon roles, they recognize, you know, that there's some legitimate argument that can be made for deaconesses in the church and women serving in that deacon role, but they have chosen as a congregation to not pursue that any further, and all of their deacons are men, because the way they have structured their deacon is that group does contain a certain measure of authority by the areas of service that they're in. And they do train their deacons in such a way that they are given significant responsibility that would someday, you know, potentially help them in a role as a shepherd of a congregation, as an elder. And number five is more of a practical concern. If a church already has a lot of timid or reluctant or spiritually immature men, women taking deacon roles could push them even further into complacency. You could make that argument. And I know that that's a generalization, but I think there's a certain truth to that too, that a lot of times women grow up spiritually more quickly than men do. That's a generalization, but I think that bears out in some ways. Many of the spiritual powerhouses in a church are the women, and sometimes it takes a lot more time and a lot more prodding for a man to become a spiritual leader, in his family, in his home, a spiritual leader in the body of Christ. So I think you could make that argument. All right, now let me get into some of the arguments for women serving as deacons, a deaconess role. Biblical deaconing is about service and not about authority. And Scripture nowhere forbids women from serving as deacons. So that's the first argument that you could make. So when Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, 12, I don't permit a woman to teach or have authority over men. Just practically, who are the ones who teach and have authority over men in the church? It's the elders. It's the elders. And to a certain degree, it's me as the minister, as your preacher. I have an authority that has been delegated to me by the elders of the congregation. So unlike elders, biblically speaking, deacons are not charged with shepherding the flock. Acts 20, 28, or 1 Peter 5, 2. Unlike elders, deacons are not charged to give instruction in sound doctrine and to rebuke those who contradict it. But that is specifically something asked of elders. Unlike elders, deacons will not answer for the spiritual welfare of individual souls that they're entrusted with, from Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17. The church is never told, be subject to the deacons, but they are told that to elders. A church is never told, obey your deacons and submit to them, but a church is told to obey your elders and to submit to them. So there's a, biblically speaking, deacon is not about authority. Deaconing is about service. So a second argument that you can make is that the more straightforward translation of gunakas in 1 Timothy 3:11 is women, not wives. Because Paul uses the word gunakas eight times, other times in 1 Timothy, arguably all of which are best translated as women, not wives. And most of the time that word is translated as women. And a couple other things about this 1 Timothy text. Well, let's just get it out there. In the same way, the gunakas, their wives, or women deacons, must be respected and must not slander others, and they must exercise self-control and be faithful in everything they do. So one thing about this word, their wives, the possessive pronoun is not in the original text. It's not in the Greek. It's not in the Greek. The second thing about that, verse 11 functions identically to other verses used before this, and you can see this in most any English translation. An overseer must be, in the same way deacons must be, verse 8, in the same way deaconesses or women deacons must be. So there's a structural flow there that is taking place. And then one other consideration. Oops. If you do translate women as their wives, why would Paul list qualifications for deacon wives but not say anything about elder wives? He's talking about, there's all this about character, but why would he not talk about elder wives, but then specifically talk about the character of deacon wives? So that's a question that you need to think about and you could ask. All right. Number three, diakonon, best translated as deacon, not servant, in Romans chapter 16, verse 1. The word diakonos, or some form of it, occurs 22 times in the epistles. And for example, the King James Version, it's translated as minister 18 times, deacon 3 times, and the only time the King James translates it as servant is in Romans 16:1, because the text in Romans refers to a woman, and women deacons were against the regular practice of the church at that time. So you might not like that, but that is an argument that could be made. And so this is an issue of translation. So, like, why did the translators choose to transliterate the word baptism instead of to just translate that word, to plunge or to dunk? They kept the word baptism as just transliterated as baptism because they weren't baptizing by immersion in that tradition at that time. And so they moved that Greek word over. So translators do have a lot of power in what they, you know, present. And there is an impetus for trying to do translations that are going to be most in line with the current practices that are going on in the group anyway. So that's another thing that we could consider. So let's look at that text from Romans chapter 16. I commend to you our sister Phoebe, who is a deacon in the church in Cenchrea. Welcome her in the Lord as one who is worthy of honor among God's people. Help her in whatever she needs, for she has been helpful to many and especially to me. Romans 16, 1 to 2, that's from the New Living Translation, that version there. In the original language, that word diakonon, it's masculine. It's in the masculine tense. If it were a word that was supposed to only be referring to Phoebe as a servant, servanthood, it should be in the feminine form to match the gender of the person it's talking about. But that word is not in the feminine. It remains masculine. The reason why you would keep that word as in the masculine form is if it happened to be referring to an office or a title or some officially recognized position. And Phoebe's deaconing isn't just some general service to the Lord. It is tied to a specific church. The literal word, a literal word-for-word translation would read something like this: I commend to you the sister of ours, Phoebe, being the diaconon of the ecclesia in Cenchrea. Ecclesia is the word typically used for church or the assembly. So it is because it is tied to a specific congregation, it's very actually hard to translate that as servant. And I think, I mean, this is an argument of Bible translators and stuff like that, but it's something that needs to be considered and worked out. So we know that Phoebe was from Cenchrea. We know that she was serving Paul in Corinth. And it looks like she is about, because she's commended at the end of Romans, it looks like she was entrusted with this work of bringing the epistle Romans to the Roman church. And so this is a woman who was serving all over the place. But Paul uses the word deacon tied to this church in Cenchrea because Phoebe was a formal deacon of that specific congregation. All right, another argument here, number four. Should timidity or laziness or immaturity of some men be a legitimate reason to keep women from serving as deacons? Or is it possible we could imagine something, the possibility of doing this in such a way that it was empowering both to men and women while still remaining true to the biblical texts that we have? So that's another question to consider. If the argument against women serving in this role is, well, our guys are already shuffling their feet and they're not going to step up if this happens, and I'm not talking about changing what happens in this room necessarily with our worship. I'm talking about service of the church and roles of service. So that's another thing you could consider is thinking creatively, what would the logistics of this look like if we were to do something different? Does it necessarily mean it's going to disempower and discourage the men of this congregation? And at the same time, we got to look at the heart. What is the heart of this woman who would like something like this? Is there a controlling eagerness that you kind of makes you a little nervous? Or, you know, I don't know. But I think that the character question still would remain. And then finally, the fifth argument. Besides the New Testament, there is overwhelming extra-biblical evidence of deaconesses in the early church. It's just all over the place. And I'm just going to show you a few of these examples so you just don't think Calvin's making this stuff up. I can show you some of those. This is from Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan. This is written sometime, probably shortly after the Apostle John died. Accordingly, I judged it all the more necessary to find out what the truth was by torturing two female slaves who were called deaconesses. But I discovered nothing else but depraved, excessive superstition. And then the quote goes on. So they had this title. This is from this, for, you know, into the very early second century, extra biblical source there. Clement of Alexandria, we are also aware of all the things that the noble Paul prescribed on the subject of female deacons in one of the two epistles to Timothy. He's talking about what we have in 1 Timothy chapter 3. So very early on, they recognized this as what Paul was talking about. Not deacon wives, but women who are in this role of deaconing in the churches. Origen of Alexandria, a little later, 2nd century. Romans 16:1 teaches two things, that there are women deacons in the church and that women who have given assistance to so many people and who by their own good works deserve to be praised by the apostle ought to be accepted in the deaconate. Diaconate, I don't know how you say that. John Chrysostom, third century there, or fourth. Some have thought that 1 Timothy 3:11 is said of women generally, but it is not so. For why should Paul introduce anything about women to interfere with his subject? He is speaking of those who hold the rank of deaconess. These are extra-biblical sources. It just existed in the early church. There's too much evidence there to deny it. All right, so here's what I think. I think it's okay for a church to decide whether or not they want to have this role, whether or not they want to have women as deacons, and they or not have them. And I think they can clarify what those reasons are. We think we should do this for this and this and this reason, and this is where we stand on this. But the question we need to keep before us, I think, is that in this needs to be done, if it was to be done, and I'm not saying that it should be done, in a way that honors Christ first. And it doesn't distract from the mission that we've been given, to discipleship and to seek and save the lost. In a way that you, and the way that we look at this, I don't want this to be a divisive thing that causes contention. I'm just putting the arguments out there. I'm just trying to share as best I understand as your minister. I don't want any of this to be a distraction from the good works that we're doing. I really don't. But to say that women deacons are against the Bible, that's simply not true. I just don't see that. And you might not like me saying that, but the best exegesis that I have with the training that I've been given and the examples of history that I've looked at and wrestling with these things, I'm just being open and honest with you about this. And since I'm already opening a big can of worms this morning, I want to talk about another role for women that existed in the early church that was later on pushed aside or forgotten. And that is the role of the listed widow. A widow who is put on the list for support must be a woman who is at least 60 years old and was faithful to her husband. She must be well respected by everyone because of the good she has done. Has she brought up her children well? Has she been kind to strangers and served other believers humbly? Has she helped those who are in trouble? Has she always been ready to do good? Since we're already dealing with texts in 1 Timothy, I just thought I'd throw this into the mix. So there looks like to be three different categories of women, women who are widows that Paul is addressing in 1 Timothy. We have younger widows who had the possibility of remarriage and family support, and that's why they had to be at least over this age 60. Younger widows, maybe they still crave the touch of a man. Maybe they still crave a sense of companionship. There's reasons why it would be probably better for them not to be put in that role, because there's still possibility of other pulls that they wouldn't want to take away from that pledge of serving a church in this way. And then there are bereaved widows who are truly destitute with no family help possible, and those are widows who are in need of the benevolence of the church, just because they have nothing else possible. So they're destitute. And then finally, you have this listed group, the listed widows, who appear to be supported ministers in a church. And here's the criteria required for them to be listed or enrolled as a widow: one who has brought up children, so with the necessary experience to have orphans, to help orphans in the community placed in her care. Someone, a woman who's got by experience, is competent to help care for children. One who has shown hospitality and washed the saints' feet. She can maintain a house. She can provide a space for fellowship, potentially. Provide a guest room for receiving traveling Christians. In the first century, the first centuries of the church, this would have been so crucial. There wasn't a Motel 6 or a Holiday Inn right around the corner. Number three, one who has helped the afflicted and devoted herself to doing good in every way. She's able to provide nursing care for the sick and needy. Very important role, and not gossip or busybodies, but visiting younger women to teach and admonish them. Discipling younger women. We have examples of that in Titus as well. We're almost done. Well, hopefully, I've given you some good stuff to think about this morning. I'm okay if you don't agree with everything I've shared, but I hope it's got you thinking. And if I were to just kind of take broad brushstrokes at some of this stuff, and this is all Calvin, by the way, but I don't know that there might be truth to some of this. The way power and authority in the church changed over time, from what it was in the very earliest stage to what it became later on. Early on, local churches were led by a plurality of co-equal elders. Early on, deacons were just servants involved in good works for the local church. It was just completely a role of service. Deaconesses served local churches and were especially involved in ministry to children and other women. And then listed widows ran visitation and hospitality ministries for the local church, and they were involved in discipling and teaching younger women in the congregation. That's the earliest picture. That's the picture we get looking at 1 Timothy. Later on, elderships changed, and you have a single bishop who held authority over multiple churches. Later on, deacons served bishops specifically, and the deacons became a position of wielding authority. The role became even hierarchical, where you have archdeacons, and deacons is the one in charge of church property. And so there, you have all these deacons who are becoming very rich in the role. Deaconesses were pushed aside as the role of deacon became more associated with authority. Because now, if deaconing is about a level of authority, there's not room for that. And listed widows as supported minister of the church, that was just forgotten completely in history. It was just a handful of congregations who did this. Well, concludes our sermon series on deacons. The third lesson that I've got here. So Lord willing, we are going to dig back into Hebrews, and we'll be talking about faith next week. Some of my favorite chapters of Hebrews we're gonna get into. So to close this morning, let me just say that the ministry of deacons is a ministry of service. And while we may have specifically delegated roles, service is something that each one of us needs to be involved in the church. And until you become a servant, you really can't be a healthy Christian. If you're just coming and you're a religious consumer, it's until you actually dig in and you serve people for the sake of Christ, people who are oftentimes unappreciative, people who will take advantage of you and your generosity, people who aren't necessarily deserving. You know, but that's the example that we have in our Savior. Did Jesus Christ himself ever serve people who were not deserving of his time and attention? Absolutely, everyone. Servanthood, as it is the very core of our faith, because it is an example that is given to us by the Lord. And so, verse from Luke 22 to close out. Who is more important, the one who sits at the table or the one who deacons? That word diakonos shows up in Luke 22. The one who sits at the table, of course, but not here. For I am among you as one who deacons. That's the example that we have to keep foremost before us at all times. If you need the prayers of this church, if you want to put the Lord on in baptism and start that new life of discipleship in a special way of dying to yourself and being born again in the power of the Spirit to receive the gift of the Holy Spirit, we offer an invitation every week, and you can find me up here. Thank you. for your consideration this morning. Let's go ahead and stand and sing our invitation song together.